the destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, April 1st, 2025. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Rachel Cohen, lawyer formerly of Skatton, Arps, Slate, Meager, and Flom, recently quit over that law firm's capitulation to Donald Trump. Also on the program today, it's election day. Wisconsin Supreme Court race, record-breaking spending. Meanwhile, two races in Florida, there are surprises that even one of them could be contentious. We will be talking about that later. Trump, meanwhile, launches the next wave of attacks on our functioning government. Massive layoffs in health agencies and more. And tomorrow is Tariffs Day or Liberation Day?
It's the new Emancipation Proclamation.
Oh, jeez. As it becomes clear that Trump is seeking a huge transfer of wealth upward. Senate Republicans attempting budgetary sleight of hand may just ignore the parliamentarian.
You can do that?
I wanted a thunderclap, but I had the wrong board up. Trump sued over his executive order imposing unconstitutional restrictions on voting. And Trump thugs send more people to El Salvador in prison after admitting they sent a Maryland father with legal status to rot in essentially what is a dungeon. Proud Boys and right-wing militias now mobilizing to pro-Musk protests. In Gaza, Israel kills 15 Palestinian paramedics one by one and then buried them in a mass grave. Trump task force threatens Harvard. And a federal judge delays Trump's temporary protected status rescission for Venezuelans. Cory Booker holds the floor for 18 hours while Chuck Schumer naps.
We will rest.
That's a good point. And advanced bookings for Canada-U.S. flights through the summer are down 70% year over year. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is
Newsday Tuesday.
Newsday Tuesday. We've got so much to get through. I should say, I realized when I got into the office that today was April 1st, April Fool's Day. I hadn't thought about it, and so we don't have a April Fool's Day
like
show again.
Legalized comedy.
But if you want, go back, and we still have some of the Ken stuff.
You got to
put more of it up.
Yeah.
If you go on YouTube to Ken and Ken Show, you can see some of our, I think some of them were April Fool's or some of them were Halloween. I don't know. So go check that out. Sorry. Don't have more than that for you. We're going to get later in the program to talk about the massive cuts, 10,000 people at various agencies, health agencies, ranging from primarily the FDA, which does food and drug safety. Presumably, It's going to be, I mean, this is the most libertarian philosophy, and I've heard it for years and years, and it's just absolutely absurd. And frankly, also, well, I've heard it from like hardcore libertarians, people who say, I'm a libertarian, so, like literally where they had to, you know, Tim Carney, when I used to be on MSNBC with him, Dylan Radigan's show, everything was prefaced, I'm a libertarian, so. The idea that agencies can be corrupted, that they can be bought out by corporate influence, is very, very real. The idea that the solution to diminishing corporate power over our government is to shrink government is one of the dumbest ideas introduced in modern times, particularly relative to how serious the people are who present it.
Oh, they're the richest people in the world.
Strength is a dynamic. Power is a dynamic. It does not exist in a vacuum. If you shrink government, you are ceding whatever power the corporations wanted to take from government. You're ceding it to the corporations.
Right.
Jeff Bezos came. Bill Gates came. Mark Zuckerberg came.
They all came. This is also a very old Republican adage, but it's made even more obviously insincere, or its insincerity is shown by the fact that the people that are making this case are literally billionaires who are ransacking the government for their own ends.
Not just billionaires. I mean, you could see it. I mean, we're going to play a clip from Ezra Klein.
Yeah.
Which at the end of the day is almost the exact same dynamic. As if people don't understand, like, government is some entity that exists in a vacuum. And there's one person in there pressing a lever. Government is a process. And what the output of that process is a function of input and what's happening with that process. And that process at times can be one way and it can be another way. And those two, the difference between those two ways is less corporate influence, more corporate influence. There's always corporate influence. It's just a question of how intense it is. But we'll talk about that. I only raise that because RFK, his whole thing was like, corporate capture.
Big pharma.
In these regulatory agencies. And the idea that you get rid of corporate capture by attacking what it's capturing is just absurd.
Or firing the inspectors general who would find the waste and fraud that they're saying is the result of this corporate capture. It's entirely unclear.
Those are two different sort of camps that both have their desire to basically allow for corporate power.
Right.
The way that you keep people from taking hostages is you kill all the hostages. And just keep killing the hostages. We'll talk more about that in a moment. But speaking of kidnapping, more information. And of course, we're only going to get this in dribs and drabs, right? Because they sent 300 people to essentially a dungeon, a gulag in El Salvador. And there is no doubt in my mind, and ostensibly because they were all members of a gang, a criminal terrorist gang. We have no way of knowing if that's actually true because their only methodology seems to be like tattoos.
One of our goons saw a tattoo on his arm.
We will only hear, and it will take a while, and we probably won't hear from all of them, from people who had full-on legal status. Because it's possible there were people on those planes who were not here, were here without documents. Maybe they overstayed their visa. Maybe they came into the country. Their parents took them. Or maybe they came across the border without documents. We will not hear from them because their families or their friends who may also be undocumented don't, they have no,
they're terrified.
They're not going to come forward.
They don't want to shine a spotlight on themselves.
100%.
We're seeing this when it is with healthcare, with hospitals. This is the way that the government makes a group of people go underground.
And so when we hear stories of this, two or three or four or five stories of like this, you can be sure that there was a lot more people who weren't what they say. And that's the problem with the failure of due process. Here's Jesse Waters hand waving this away. The idea that we could actually, that we claim, and here's the thing, they've got to claim that these people are in a gang to sell it politically. So who they are is obviously important, but you cannot determine who they are unless there is some type of official process which determines that. And what we call the legal term is due process.
Yeah.
It's not in the way that we use it in the vernacular.
You can't take away people's due process like that. And again, I don't trust the El Salvadorian government to be making sure that they are not torturing people, that they're vetting them properly. They need to be vetted
why
on this side.
Why do the Democrats always
say... All right, pause it for one second. I just want to say something. We say, as a shorthand, it's a person's due process. It is not a person's due process. It is a person's right to go through due process. That's a very subtle but important distinction, because the due process is supposed to exist regardless of whether there's people to go through it or not.
Yeah.
The due process exists in the same way that our laws exist. They exist whether there's people breaking them or not. Due process exists. It is the way that we adjudicate things.
It's the bedrock of our judiciary, and it's constitutionally enshrined.
People that they're vetting them properly. They need to be vetted on this side.
Why do the Democrats always say this could happen?
It did happen.
Torturing them.
Did you watch the video?
Torturing.
Yeah. Did you read the Time magazine?
Heads.
Time magazine was there when the gay barber from Venezuela who had a crown tattoo that said "Mom" was being processed coming into the El Salvadorian. Oh, am I boring you again? I'm sorry.
No, but you've been talking about this gay barber from El Salvador with some stupid tattoo for weeks.
Yeah.
Weeks, Jessica.
Come on.
It's just a gay barber.
He's not into you.
He's an innocent guy who got swept up in a deportation, and hopefully we get it figured out and straightened out. But a lot of people this country, Jessica, get arrested for things that they didn't do, get falsely accused, falsely convicted.
I'm also against racial profiling.
That doesn't mean you just stop arresting people. That doesn't mean you stop arresting criminals because one guy was arrested who was innocent.
Okay, all right. We don't need to hear anymore.
Wow.
The reason why he knows that innocent people get arrested all the time is because of due process. Because they get arrested, then they go through due process and we find out they're innocent. This guy has already received the punishment. And it might as well be capital punishment. To that end, The Atlantic reported yesterday, in the case of a father of a five-year-old disabled child,
Abrego Garcia,
he is here legally,
came to this country, a teenager,
because he was fleeing in 2011. Gang threats in El Salvador. He received in 2019 protected legal status from a U.S. immigration judge. In other words, he went through the process, who found he would likely be targeted by gangs if deported back. That's what asylum's for. He was scooped up by ICE because of a supposed clerical error. And of course, there was no due process. So there was no assessment of, like, there was no way to catch that clerical error. On March 12th, Abrego Garcia picked up his son after work from the boy's grandmother's house when ICE officers stopped the car, saying his protected status had changed. Officers waited for Abrego's wife to come to the scene to take care of the boy and then drove him away in handcuffs. A couple months later, he is sent to El Salvador. In Monday's court filing, attorneys for the government admitted that the Salvadoran man, this being Garcia, had been deported accidentally. And here's the kicker that speaks to what Waters is saying. Although ICE was aware of his protection from removal from El Salvador, Abrego Garcia was removed to El Salvador because of an administrative error, the government told the court. Trump lawyers said the court has no ability to bring Abrego Garcia back now that he's in Salvadoran custody.
They have no ability. They can stage a photo op in that El Salvador prison with the shaved heads of hundreds of men, which included innocent people that were rounded up without due process.
Who cares what those identity of those men are? Just put him in a cage.
They can do that.
They are now
saying... But they can't bring him back to his family.
It's too late.
You know what would have prevented it from being too late? If he had his due process and this was able to be delineated. Do we have this J.D. Vance tweet about this? He really thought he owned the liberal media here, responding to Jon Favreau of Pod Save America, who said, any comment on this at Marco Rubio? How about you at J.D. Vance? You just admitted to accidentally sending an innocent father from Maryland to a torturer. It's cut off here, but you get the gist. Vance responds, my comment is that according to the court document you apparently didn't read, he was a convicted MS-13 gang member with no legal right to be here. My further comment is that it's gross to get fired up about gang members getting deported when ignoring citizens they victimize. Next slide is the actual court filing, which completely contradicts what J.D. Vance was saying there.
Which says that he was accused at one point of being a member of MS-13, but because he got his due process back then, they found... In fact, he was clear to that.
Right. An informant had essentially fingered him as somebody who could have been a gang member, and there were no charges filed.
And though, you can't necessarily take... I've just been on like one grand jury duty session. You can't necessarily take the word of informants as face value. Typically, they want other evidence than one guy that works on the payroll of the cops saying, yeah, him.
They're incentivized to give information. It's the same arguments that were used against the Bush administration's use of torture during the war on terror. Information that's given under duress is not always reliable. And also the lack of reliability increases in many ways.
Did he just do this? Did he just edit?
No, this was yesterday. But this guy, Brian Metzger, who I think is with Business Insider, I'm not sure. Business Insider. So he tweeted that going after the reporter who had tweeted out the filing, and then immediately realized, FYI, I edited this post because I mistakenly believed the determination from the immigration judge had been made in 2021. Whoops, no, that wasn't correct. Edited the original post because 2019, when this determination was made, was during the Trump admin, not the Biden admin. None of this matters. He wasn't convicted of a crime like you initially said.
Oh, but he was implying that... The reason why the guy got off from being MS-13 was because of Biden, and then had to remember that. Oh wait, Trump was president.
Right. Oof. Yeah. This is also. I really want to note that gang databases and gang affiliations have been used to further mass incarceration in this country for quite a while. It's, you know, in 2016, I think it was Oregon that did away with their gang database because despite having less than 8% of their population being black at the time, 64% of people in the database were black. And you see this across a variety of different states where it's used to elevate charges against poor people and marginalized communities by saying they have gang ties. And it's very difficult to determine how they get on one, how they get off of one. And throughout this like tough on crime, broken windows policing period of our history, this was used over and over and over again. So you see how our policies at home are now, and honestly, the militarization of our police force that escalated a lot of this in the wake of 9/11, where they got all this excess military equipment and the surveillance state expanded. They're using these same tactics as that they've used against many Americans and applying that to justify the disappearances of innocent people and bragging about it, where they say, there's nothing we can do. That's Stephen Miller. That's Stephen Miller basically going like,
there's a DOJ.
Suck on this. Suck on this.
In the in their filing, the DOJ says there is no jurisdiction in habeas. Plaintiffs admit, as they must, that the United States did not have custody over Abrego Garcia. They acknowledge that there may be difficult questions of redressability in this case, reflecting their recognition that defendants don't have the power to produce Garcia from a CECOT in El Salvador. But even more, they concede that Garcia is not in defendant's custody. Essentially, they're saying, like, we dropped him off already. There's nothing we can do. The government, we can't be compelled to have this guy show up because we don't have him.
There was nothing they could do when the plane was already in the air and the judge ordered that the plane turn around. Hey, the plane's already in the air. Oh, now this guy's innocent? Well, there's nothing we can't do. Him back.
They all had a problem with the judge overruling the military plane.
Right.
These people are ghouls.
I mean, they're fascists, right? They are fascists. This is a fascist administration. And on this issue, there is no question. They are disappearing people at this moment.
We'll talk more about this later. We've got a couple of words from our sponsors. The show today is sponsored by Liquid IV. I barely have to do anything for this. Because all I have to do is take out this bottle of Liquid IV that I have here every day that I do the show. Sometimes, I think like 2 days ago, I forgot it was in the fridge.
Yeah, you had to run and go grab it.
I had to run and go get it.
You need it for the show.
I need it for the show. And I need it for my... I feel the difference at the end of the day, actually. I really do. And very little impacts me as a person, like physically. I just always have a... I'm like this. I'm flatlined. But I can feel it when I'm not drinking Liquid IV. Doesn't matter what you do. You can get extraordinary hydration from Liquid IV. It is powered by LIV Hydroscience. Liquid IV helps you break the mold. It's got flavors like Hydration Multiplier, Sugar-Free Raspberry Lemonade right here. It's a, I mean, it tastes like lemonade, but it's zero sugar. Has notes of ripe, freshly picked raspberries and citrusy. I mean, people know what raspberry lemonade tastes like. It's delicious. True to fruit flavors that keep you hydrated. They have all sorts of hydration multiple flavors on their website. Acai berry, lemon lime, pina colada. They got a raspberry melon. They got a couple. I got four, I think... four sugar-free, and then a bunch of other ones. White peach is a sugar-free. Rainbow sherbet, sort of like a fruity punch type of thing. Break the mold and your own ritual, and own your ritual, I should say. Just one stick and 16 ounces of water hydrates better than water alone. Powered by LVI Hydroscience, it's an optimized ratio of electrolytes, essential vitamins, and clinically tested nutrients that turned ordinary water into extraordinary hydration. It's got three times the electrolytes of a leading sports drink, eight essential vitamins and nutrients, always non-GMO, vegan, gluten-free, dairy-free, and soy-free. Come in really convenient packets, great for travel. I'm heading down to Florida on Thursday to do another one of those PBD things. And I'm going to take a couple of packets.
Good call.
Yep. Embrace your ritual of extraordinary hydration from Liquid IV. Get 20% off your first order of Liquid IV when you go to liquidiv.com. Use the code MajorityRep, not Majority Report. It's Majority Rep. We checked that, right, Russ? Oh, we got to introduce Russ today. Majority Rep at checkout. That's 20% off your first order when you shop Better Hydration today using promo code MajorityRep at liquidiv.com. We'll put a link in the YouTube and podcast description to that stuff. Also, every year you say you're going to learn a new language. Maybe based upon what I did yesterday, I should maybe learn a little French. but I'm focusing on Studio Español.
Mm.
But few of us actually commit to it. Babbel makes it easy for you to learn one in less time than you think. The thing that's easy about Babbel comes in very short, like 10-minute lessons. And I can knock off a couple of lessons when I'm walking to work, or I can just listen to one lesson, then I listen to music, or one lesson and an audiobook. It's great. Learning a new language is the pathway to discovering new cultures, so why not embark on learning something new? Great time to learn a new language, incidentally, with everything that's going on in this country. Babbel's, like I say, got quick 10-minute lessons. They're handcrafted over 200 language experts. Get you begin speaking your new language in 3 weeks or whatever pace you choose. And my daughter at college has been using it to learn a new language. And I'm like, why am I even bothering sending you to college?
Right. This is cheaper.
And the thing is, conversing is really the key to understanding new languages. So Babbel is designed using practical, real-world conversations. You can spend months with private teachers, the old way of learning languages, and nothing screams tourist like holding a phone translation app to your face all day. Babbel's tips and tools are inspired by the real life stuff that you actually need when you communicate. With a focus on conversation, you're going to be ready to talk wherever you go. Here's some proof. Studies from Yale, Michigan State, and other leading universities continue to prove that Babbel works. One study found that using Babbel for 15 hours is equivalent to a full semester at college. Significantly less expensive. They have over 16 million subscriptions sold. Babbel's 14 award-winning language courses are backed by a 20-day money-back guarantee. This year, get talking with Babbel. Let's get more of you talking in a new language. Babbel is giving our listeners 60% off subscriptions at babbel.com/majority. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/majority, spelled B-A-B-B-E-L, B-A-B-B-E-L.com/majority, babbel.com/majority. Rules and restrictions may apply. We'll put the links in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. Quick break. Rachel Cohen, formerly of Scat and Arps, big law in New York City and frankly, around the country. She quit as a protest to their acquiescence to the Trump administration. We'll be right back. You're back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Rachel Cohen. She is a lawyer who technically is on the payroll for a couple more days, as my understanding, at Scat and Arps, which is a one of the biggest law firms in the country. Just give it, set it for folks who don't know that world. Like, tell us about that firm. How big it is, where it fits in sort of like the legal world.
Anyone who's not familiar with that world, I am a bit jealous and wish that we could all remain unfamiliar, but unfortunately no longer the case. Skadden is one of, like you said, the largest law firms actually in the world. So we have a presence on, there's offices in Asia, in Europe, and I believe our revenues were upwards of several billion dollars with a B last year. The partners have a profit per partner that is in the seven figures, and there's a lot of kind of prestige chasing in the legal industry broadly. To the extent people care about for their employers, Skadden is very much on that list. There have been a couple of books that I've read actually where they were aimed at kind of legal audiences and the way that they shorthand characterized a bit character as someone who was well-connected, but also maybe a little bit of a, I don't know if I can say douchebag on your show because I haven't watched it that much, was that they would say that they worked at Skadden-Arps. So I'll be atoning for that for some time.
That's good context.
How many, when we say the biggest law firm in the world, tell people how many lawyers work there? How many partners are there?
It's not necessarily one of the biggest law firms in the world, but it is one of the most profitable. I would say it has like some of the widest reach. And so I believe our partnership is only about 1,000 people. I can look it up right now. But it has much more to do with the level of profit that people have and the level of access that you have. There's a reason that our executive partner, Jeremy London, was speaking with Donald Trump directly about kind of the attack on law firms that has been launched by the Trump administration over the last several weeks. These law firms, Skadden, Paul Weiss, if people are familiar, are these firms that have made major deals with the Trump administration, including promising millions of dollars worth of pro bono work to the Trump administration.
I want to get to that, because that to me is the one that really sort of resonates here. But so it starts with Paul Weiss, and ostensibly this is about Donald Trump taking vengeance against these firms that have had in the past a lot of Democratic clients. They're sort of like loosely associated with Democratic politics.
And I think Paul Weiss's partner was involved in the Stormy Daniels prosecution, the hush money case that had, you know,
and in all these firms, there is somebody who either worked maybe in the context of the Mueller investigation or in other investigations against Donald Trump. So ostensibly, it's about revenge. Give me your sense of, well, before we get to that, tell us what it is exactly. When they went to Paul Weiss, when they went to Skadden-Arps, and we should say there are other firms that have done something very different, and we'll get to those in a moment. But what is it? What is it that? How does a government? How does a federal government go and say we're going to attack or punish you? What are they threatening them with?
The government is targeting a variety of corporate law firms, and there's firms that are fighting back. There's firms that aren't, as you mentioned, targeting a variety of corporate law firms by threatening to cancel government contracts or also use the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC's enforcement mechanisms to not only remove government contracts and security clearances from firms that they claim are engaging in quote unquote illegal DEI. For two more days, boss used that term in an email sent firm-wide, which imagine being an attorney of color working 60, 70-hour weeks constantly doing outstanding work and getting an email from your boss about how they wanted to listen to the Trump administration to stamp out the illegal DEI that is happening at Skadden-Arps.
Imagine just being a lawyer and reading the words illegal DEI and saying, wait a second, a lawyer's writing this to
me? Spell it out. It's diversity, equity, and inclusion.
And accessibility, actually, we should say, at least in the government context. What can they materially do? They can cancel government contracts that cost them money directly as a first order thing. They can also, I read, inhibit their ability to go into federal buildings, which I don't know how you can't obviously like go to federal court and litigate in that instance.
And I do think, even to your point of like what they can do, I think that that's still very much being figured out. And that's why people are challenging these, because there's a lot of people, he's using these EEOC enforcement mechanisms through a certain extent. And my firm actually hadn't even been targeted by an executive order. They just received an EEOC demand letter, which, for the record, the deal they cut with Trump does not even include them dropping the EEOC demand letter or potential investigation, but they're using this kind of EEOC mechanism that a lot of former EEOC commissioners are saying is just patently illegal. They're using it wrong. And so even what they quote unquote can do, I think, is up for debate. But what they are doing,
we're talking about what they're threatening with, because we really don't know what they can do yet until it's resolved in a court of law. And you can't know what they can do until you stand up to them. And your soon to be former firm refused to do that. So we should say that it also sounds like, you know, because I'm reading this story about Coy, I guess it is. Is that the name of the
Parker's
the,
Coy?
Parker's Coy.
Yep.
Yeah. Tell us their story, because this is sort of like the alternate universe. They decide, and you know, frankly, the idea of a bunch of lawyers capitulating so quickly runs contrary to everything that I know of lawyers.
It's also a very bad deal. Even if you say these people aren't litigators, they're corporate, whatever, they went to the White House, didn't even have an executive order lodged against them, didn't get the EEOC demand letter, which requested personal information of my firm and also 19 other firms that was targeted at intimidating diverse employees, asking for name and email address and phone number and all of this stuff. They didn't even get that dropped. And they promised $100 million worth of pro bono hours to the Trump administration, which is more than twice Paul Weiss's $40 million that they promised that was a terrible deal anyway. But to jump back, and I have all of my little executive orders printed here, because this is such an esoteric and inaccessible part of the legal industry, which is already inaccessible deliberately for many people. And so even leading with kind of the way that these firms are being targeted, the executive order that was lodged against Perkins Coie, before I came on, I heard y'all talking about these deportations and kind of the Stephen Miller of it all. And I think that it's important to name that the attacks on these corporate law firms, who are not very sympathetic victims, and I do not argue with anyone that they are, the attacks here are to intimidate corporate law firms out of providing certain forms of representation. Right. And they do a lot of asylum representation. They do a lot of kind of impact litigation because they're very well resourced. And so the Perkins Coie executive order was launched explicitly naming that it was meant to be retribution because Perkins Coie had an attorney that used to work there named Mark Elias, who has since left and started his own firm that Trump really, really hates. And so we have this. But my friends and I started organizing in that moment because we read it and it was clear in the executive order that the Trump administration was going to come after additional firms. And also in a public service loan forgiveness executive order, which came out the next day, he listed all of these different things that he didn't think should qualify for public service loan forgiveness anymore. And it includes things like aiding and abetting violations of federal immigration laws. And we know what that means in Trump speak. It includes things like supporting terrorism. We know what that means in Trump speak. Child abuse, including the chemical and surgical castration or mutilation of children, or the trafficking of children to so-called transgender sanctuary states. He's outlining what kind of work he does not want attorneys to be doing. And he followed it up, I believe, weekend before last, March 21st, it posted on the 22nd, with directions to the attorney general to sanction attorneys that are engaged in this kind of representation.
And they can go back 8 years to assess whether these attorneys have been filing frivolous actions against the government simply based upon whether they lost. Yep. And so, you know, of course,
if Trump was to apply that standard to himself, I'm not necessarily sure he would be able to do so with the level of frivolity. I mean, but his frivolous lawsuits were getting rewarded with this anticipatory obedience by what? It was the other media organizations that gave in, but the law firms, too.
Yeah, so, and it is anticipatory, and it's also all projection, right? But I'm sorry, Sam, please.
Well, no. But I mean, I think the point you're making here is that this is all any reason why they went after these firms was a pretense to basically say you do not bring cases against us for immigration or any of our policy objectives that we want, and if you do. Because Perkins Coie, they lost one or two clients. Apparently other clients were like, we appreciate what you're doing. But that's what this is about, right? I mean, it's about these law firms worrying that they're going to lose access, worrying that they're going to make targets out of their clients, right? Like, I mean, if Scott and Arbs is like representing, I don't know, pick a client, the federal government could be coming after these clients just because of their association with Scott and Arbs. I mean, that is that's the fear here.
It is the fear, but it's also so ridiculous because it seems like all of these very smart people should understand. And I did work with them, and I do think that they're very smart, no matter how determined they are to prove me wrong over the last couple of days. But we have all of these very smart people, and surely you have to understand that you are not going to win by giving in to a bully like the Trump administration. And I think it's this kind of like historical condescension where we're convinced that we can sit around and say, well, Neville Chamberlain, what a fool when he was just giving in to the German demands. But do we think it was more obvious at that time? Or do we think that we just for some reason believe that we're smarter than all of these people that are not that much older than us, are still human beings that are smarter than us? It's not as clear as people think it is. And people are acting like it's still 2016. They're determined to prove that they're smarter than Donald Trump is. And whether that's true or not, right now, it doesn't appear to be because you are getting outplayed.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right. I mean, I think it's very scary. I think, you know, once they come for the lawyers, mm-hmm. once they basically say to the lawyers, you can't represent a certain various groups in our society. And the lawyers say, okay, then it's just the floodgates are open. Because right now, as it stands, there's, you know, I mentioned this yesterday on the program. There's about two or three things that are basically slowing the roll of the Trump administration. One is any type of political pressure. And we see that with the elections that are taking place today, mm-hmm. because that undermines the confidence maybe of some lawmakers. But there's only so much that's going to do. And the other is organizing amongst people, broadly speaking, labor, whatnot. But at this very moment, the one thing that is slowing the roll is like the 80 some odd, maybe now 90 cases that have been brought against the Trump administration in various forms that are slowing their roll. Now, here's the other thing about the you brought up the pro bono stuff. The Trump administration now, like I say, is dealing with all of these lawsuits, whether they're from the ACLU, whether they're from the Brennan Center, whether they're from Perkins Coie, all across the board. Mm-hmm. They don't have the resources to deal with all of these cases that are coming in. The DOJ, if anything, they have less resources than they had 6 months ago because they're firing all these prosecutors. They're firing all these DOJ people. They're installing political appointees. Not always the brightest bulbs, frankly.
Not at all. And I don't think that you can be a good attorney and work for the Trump administration because it requires you to kind of bend and disregard the law in so many different ways and the system itself in so many different ways that even if you are smart, you're probably not a very good attorney if you're working for that administration in this moment.
I think that's absolutely the case. We saw that just with the federal prosecutors in the Southern District who had to resign because they're just like, none of this makes sense.
Yep.
Where is that pro bono work going? That's what I want to know, because it seems to me that we could have, instead of, and this is aside from the fact that these are firms that were already doing pro bono work. Mm-hmm. They have a limited amount. I mean, I know this too. Like, they don't expand. This isn't an extra $100 million worth of pro bono work they're doing. They're going to be not doing other pro bono work to do this pro bono work. So there's an opportunity cost that's associated with it. But where are they deploying these resources? Because we could have a situation where Skatnarb's attorneys are fighting to deport people.
And it may just really quickly make sense to describe what pro bono work is more broadly for the audience and these corporate law firms' relationship with it too, what it traditionally is and what the administration may be wanting.
Yeah, thank you so much, Emma, because I think that it's a super crucial piece of the puzzle here. So it's tough because you don't want to come on to any type of outward facing media and act like corporate law firms that often charge upwards of $3,000 an hour for top partners, that they're on the front lines of justice work. We know that they are not. And we know the people that are doing that work are historically extremely underfunded because of the nature of American capitalism. And so we have these law firms that kind of say to people that are coming out of law school and really want the high paycheck that, okay, we know that a lot of our clients, a lot of the representations that you'll be doing are just very, very well resourced and maybe not exactly in the pursuit of justice, though they are in the pursuit of an adversarial legal system, which I think goes back to Sam's point around we need lawyers to bring cases because we don't have like a sua sponte legal system where stuff just goes to the courts when it's unconstitutional. You have to have lawyers to bring those cases. And that ties into the kind of pro bono work because what law firms will do to kind of entice people to do some reputation management. And also, I really thought because they believed in it, though it's certainly not appearing that way, as those values are kind of put to the test against losing a modicum of profit, we have corporate law firms that will partner with a variety of the organizations that you just listed, ACLU, Brennan Center, et cetera, or even kind of more local organizations. And firms will allow their associates to do that pro bono work and count a certain number of hours or unlimited number of hours. Last year, I think I did over 350 hours of pro bono work towards my bonus requirement. They'll allow them to count it towards their bonus. And so you get people who kind of, it's viewed as mutually beneficial. It's you're training up, you get more responsibility. You also get to work on things that you care about. And so if we have large corporate law firms that are the best resourced and often ally with these organizations because they have just enormous amounts of staffing, though I did overstate and looked it up, and I think we only have like 350 partners at Skadden, which is crazy because, like I said, the revenue per year is in the billions with a B. But we have these people who are very well resourced who can kind of throw their weight and training behind these causes because otherwise they just don't have enough attorneys. And that's not because, like, thank God for big law. That's just the reality of the system in which we live and where resources have been allocated. And so I'm not arguing that that's normatively good, but it is really necessary within the legal system as currently existing. And so you have people that are being intimidated out of doing certain kinds of pro bono work. And you have all of these firm leaders saying, no, we're still committed to pro bono. But 2 weeks ago, they were saying the exact same thing about DEI. They won't put any of it in writing. And you have the government taking these firms, asking them to do millions of dollars worth of work for them, while also issuing the kinds of executive orders and guidance and fact sheets, quote unquote fact sheets, we're using that as in the way that the administration uses it. We have them putting out these things, directing public interest attorneys to be punished, being stripped of their public student or their public service loan forgiveness if they work at certain organizations. So it's a multi-tiered attack. He's also attacking judges, but I think it's actually quite smart that he went to these large corporate law firms first, because it was a huge gamble. If they'd all united and stood up to him, it would have really undercut this all-out assault on the legal system. But the first time I read one of the executive orders, I said to myself, he has somebody inside doing this work who has worked at one of these places before, because he is betting on their kind of capitalistic cowardice to keep them from standing up for what's right. And I think that people's heads are so in the sand. They're so convinced that it's 2016 all over again, even though in 2016 they actually did stand up to the Trump administration, but they've been laying the groundwork for this for a very long time. The right is good at that. I have a case here that was, the opinion came out on March 14th, 2025. It's called RNC v. Justin Wetzel. It was a voting rights case. There's this judge on the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in Texas named James Ho. You may be familiar.
Remind people, the Fifth Circuit is, there's essentially really a couple of judges down there that the right will venue shop. They will go down to the Fifth Circuit. They know there's a couple of venues within the Fifth Circuit, which is down in Texas, one of the states, where when they basically go into the lottery for judges, there's only like two judges there, and they know who they're getting. And there was an attempt by the federal judicial essentially association to change that mechanism they had been using to venue shop. And they got so much pushback that they basically walked away from it. And so we're left with this. But that's why every time we hear one of these rulings, they'll come out of the Fifth Circuit.
Very much so. And so James Ho files the concurrence. He agrees in the judgment. No need to write an opinion. And he writes a concurrence that's 2 pages about how pro bono at corporate law firms has been biased for so long. There's another explanation. The pro bono activity in this case may just reflect the institutional bias at many of the nation's largest law firms. And then he cites some articles that are published in journals that are extremely right-leaning. We have the Federalist Society, which is a right-leaning organization on law school campuses that was founded decades ago, that put out their own journals so that people can write extremely biased things and then cite to it. It's kind of the legal journal of Fox News. And cites to things about pro bono institutional bias as if the reason that pro bono tilts towards people who do not have resources is because those firms are biased and not because that's who needs free legal work. And so this is a really just across the board, intentional, well planned out. It's brilliant, even though I think that it is normatively evil plan to undercut all of these things. And then you have big law attorneys who are convinced that they're smarter than the Trump administration and they can outmaneuver him.
Do you think that they're convinced that they're smarter than him and they're outmaneuvering him and they're going to be sly about this? Or do you think it's like at the end of the day, they're just like, well, let's make this less friction. Let's just make this more frictionless and we'll just, it doesn't matter to us.
I wish that it was the latter because I would understand that more, but I worked with these people for years. I worked with them for years. They genuinely just think that they are smarter than he is. And it's extremely troubling. And listen, I grew up in Ohio. I went to Ohio State and then I went to Harvard Law School. And it's something that I've seen play out over and over again. I hate to invoke the coastal elitism of it all because I think that that veers into anti-intellectualism sometimes. And that's not it. We want people to read, to understand, to engage with the world. And it's not bad to do those things. But to assume that your educational credentials mean that you are smarter than someone who is a Republican because they grew up in, you know, a different place than you are. And that's what we see a lot of the time. There's this belief in many of these white shoe corporate law firms and in many of these liberal spaces broadly with people with strong educational credentials that the reason that these decisions are being made is just because the people making them are stupid. And that is so fundamentally incorrect. They are outplaying us. And there are people that need to be educated and engaged with 100%, but they are not Stephen Miller. They are not sitting in the White House making these decisions right now. And that's the way that law firm leaders are treating it. My understanding is that the line on the ground at Skadden right now to associates is that Skadden got a great deal because they didn't really promise him anything at all. They just promised $100 million in pro bono work and they get to decide what the pro bono work is. And the second anyone pushes on it, the partners that are saying it don't have answers for them, but have drunk the Kool-Aid of their own intellectual superiority so deeply that it's going to be too late before they figure out that they don't.
They don't understand that. I mean, frankly, Donald Trump, at the end of the day, if he doesn't get that $100 million worth of pro bono work, he still got what he wanted, which was to show that he could intimidate a firm like this. So yep. If you're a smaller firm or you're an immigration attorney, you got your own, you're doing it on your own and you're going against the government in an immigration proceedings. You're terrified right now. You're terrified.
And that's the thing that I'm so glad that you brought that back up because it's so important that we bring back around. It's not about kind of the comeuppance of the corporate law firms. It is about the people legally in this country who are getting deported or indefinitely detained over free speech rights or who are just due process rights violated right and left. And that is the ultimate end game here. It's not about the law firms. And that's why I quit, right? Like, it's not about, oh no, my firm might get embarrassed. It's people are going to die. And they probably already have.
And in terms of it rings very true to me what you're saying, just the idea that they think they're smarter than, they think this is Sidney Powell or something like this all over again, as opposed to a very well-coordinated, pre-planned lawfare, legal assault, essentially, from the attorney general who's going to do whatever Trump wants. It's frankly the problem with the Democratic Party, where they think their views should be self-evident as opposed to being, and the virtue of their views being smarter is self-evident as opposed to making their case to the public. But that's a bit of an aside. Do you have a sense of what they want the pro bono work to be reoriented towards? Like, is this about cracking down on anti-Semitism, aka kids on college campus exercising their free speech rights? Because that's what it smells like to me, at the very least.
I am quite confident that that's one of the directions that it will be going in. And I think there's so much rhetoric that the Democratic Party and maybe those that criticize the critics is the word I was looking for. I also am not really my own intellect in this moment, critics are leaning into is rhetoric that's really harmful here, right? Like focusing on the fact that some of the people that are being deported had no criminal history. That we care about everyone's due process rights. Like we don't want to lean into some of this is okay. It's okay for some people to not have due process rights and not others. The notion of Pam Bondi is like Barbie Bondi, this playing into her as a moron when there's this clearly targeted attack. And then very much what you said, the branding around this task force to combat anti-Semitism is incredibly deliberate. My name is Rachel Cohen. I don't practice, but I've had an internet presence for some period of time. And I'm well aware that anti-Semitism exists. And so to position, though, the notion that the biggest threat to any minority in this country is an op-ed written against dropping bombs on children and not an authoritarian government that is picking and choosing due process and free speech rights. If they win that kind of marketing battle, and they're very close to it, we are in far deeper trouble than anyone has identified outside of a few spaces like this one.
Tell me just like your perspective on, I mean, you've worked with the folks at that firm, you went through law school, you probably have a sense of what the people at Paul Weiss are like, you may know some. Mm-hmm. Are you surprised that you're the only attorney to quit?
I'm not the only attorney. Two other people at Skadden have already quit since they announced their deal.
Is that right? Okay.
Several others I know have quit who were not willing to kind
go
of
public.
I don't think that they will do media in the same way. Some of them might. But I think that people at Skadden are organizing around refusing to recruit. They are holding, my understanding is that someone quit yesterday at the end of a town hall meeting, and the rest of the group stood up and applauded him as he walked out. So I will say this, I don't know where the Paul Weiss people are, because I'm not familiar of any of them quitting. But I will say none of this is to apologize for the big law industry. None of it is to say that the Skadden reputation and characterization isn't a little bit warranted. But I stayed at that firm for as long as I did because the people that I worked alongside believed in pro bono the same way that I did, believed in the justice system the same way that I did, even if we recognized that we were in this kind of very, very profit-centric space. And I think that we will probably see other people quit, but even if we don't, I think that you're going to see really powerful organizing. It's just a risk-averse industry, and a lot of people, it's been an incredible opportunity to get to do this kind of media. It's also unbelievably overwhelming, and I do not fault anyone who doesn't want to do it.
And can you, when you, we appreciate you coming on, your thought there sparked a question for me. Is there a really noticeable split between the associates, you're a third year associate, and the partners at the firm? And if you could explain how the partners have this very, a much more direct financial stake in, you know, the clients and how they're more likely to, you know, obviously cave on this front.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much for opening, because I think that's important to understand as well. So Skadden is an equity partnership only structure. Most of these law firms have an equity partner and then like a junior or income partner tier. And if you're equity partner only, all of the profits that go in, and you might get a little bit of additional profits if you're the person that brought the client in, for example, but ultimately you're profit splitting with the rest of the partnership. And so I've gotten the question a lot if this is a generational divide. I don't think that it is. And I think that and that's not what you asked, to be fair. I'm voicing that because I'm sure there's people that are watching that are wondering the same
thing. But it overlaps. It overlaps. Yeah.
It does. And you're a little older if you're a partner, obviously. And I think that the way that this all kind of ties into the kind of anti-intellectual, like the notion that young generations just get it and older generations just don't, I think is one that's really harmful. And there's so many lovingly referred to as old heads, right, that we can learn so much from. They just don't stay in the industry long enough to make partner, even if they go into big law for a couple of years, as I did, to build up some financial stability, get trained up, you know, see, I really wanted to understand the private sector. I understand that that came with a lot of financial benefit to me and working for clients that I didn't always agree with. And so I make no apologies for that because there are no apologies to be made. I also did learn a lot. And so people stay and they make partner. And if they've self-selected, they probably are a little bit more of a believer in institutions than I would personally identify. But I think that many of them understand just how out of left field this is. I think many of them understand that Donald Trump has authoritarian tendencies. And what I find fascinating is that they seem to think that someone else will fix it. And that's one of the things that made me, I experienced it at Harvard all the time, is you'd go in and people would say, can't believe no one's doing anything about this. And I'd be like, your dad's a senator. What are you talking about? And so one of the reasons that I've decided to be so public on this, and something that I think is so important for people to remember, I have an unbelievable amount of privilege. I am also just one person backed by a lot of other people. And I hope that it is encouraging to see what can happen when you are organized with people that you really believe in, and one person is willing to speak about something that is happening. Because whether we win or not, I know that if no one had spoken on this, the story would have died quite quickly. Because you have to have someone that's able to go and explain it and talk about it and all of these things. And it's such an important story, and it's such a difficult one to understand if you're not in the industry. It's so possible for a couple of us to do the right thing and have it mean something. And so if you're questioning and you're feeling so overwhelmed, this wasn't just me standing alone, right? This is friends whose values, it was a big values test to be in this industry following October 7th. And to be in kind of a high profile client facing industry, as conversations were ongoing about not just US military policy, but also the rising transphobia of the Democratic Party and the willingness to sell people out. Those things are pressure tests. And once you know that you can trust people and organize with them, you've got your group. Like, it, I hate to say it, because I also, just like those partners, keep waiting for someone else to do this stuff. But at a certain point, if no one's doing it, you have to do it. You have to. Someone has to.
Yeah.
Rachel Cohen, thank you so much for your time today. Very much looking forward to what you do next. Keep us in the loop. Really appreciate both your coming on and telling us about it, and every step you're taking, and all those folks who have left that firm in solidarity, and those who are staying and trying to figure out a way of, I don't know, undermining some of this stuff from within. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to explain.
Thank you.
All right, folks. We are going to head into the, I guess, the fun half now. We had some other stories to do, but that was just a lot more impressive and important than I think I had anticipated. Inspiring.
The poll was
amazing.
Yeah, amazing. And luckily, it seems like some firms are beginning to stand up. The Paul Weiss thing was just like a complete capitulation. I feel like that was the first domino to fall, especially given the firm's history. But maybe there's more, like, I'm not necessarily, like, Wilmer Hale might be, I think, standing up. That's full disclosure. That was my dad's firm. My sister works there now. But they had Robert Mueller as a part of their firm as well. But I think they're maybe holding the line, at least for right now.
And we should say, like, this spirit of dissent and of fighting and of not capitulating, you can do this in just about whatever. You can do this in organizations that you're in. You can do this in professions and neighborhood associations. It's super important that we elevate institutions, entities, people who speak out, because it provides courage to other people. We're entering a very intimidating and scary era in our country. And, there's really basically three options: fight, flight, and acquiescence. And, really, at the end of the day, only fighting is going to keep this role. I will say this again. It was not clear to people that Nazis were Nazis in the way that we understand Nazis today in 1925 or 1927 or in 1935, maybe even.
We had rallies in this country in support of the Nazi cause, one that was seemingly deliberately invoked by the Trump campaign just recently in Madison Square Garden.
We had the Klan. Like, you know, we don't need to reference Europe. We had the Klan here, Jim Crow South. That was, I mean, Robert Paxton, who's wrote The Anatomy of Fascism, talks about that as a proto-fascism. This is homegrown. It's secessionist. The way that
there's also a good argument, frankly, that the Nazis got the ideas for a lot of the like eugenics in the from over here.
They got a decent, decent amount of the
But but within the context of a successful takeover. And launching of authoritarian government, we just don't know. No one has experienced, well, maybe not no one, but for the vast majority of us have not experienced it. And there is no doubt, there's no way to predict where we will be in, frankly, 6 months or 18 months or 12 months or 24 months. But I can tell you that if there is such a thing as losing a democracy, as sort of shabby as ours was, we are in the process of losing it.
It would look a lot like what we're experiencing in this moment.
It would look identical.
Right.
Like, right. I mean, this is the, you know, we have television commentators poo-pooing due process. We have the most successful and profitable law firms in the world basically saying, we're not going to go to court. Okay, like
universities.
I mean, think about the cowardice associated in a law firm. That judge that they would go to, like, they've got to probably, for the most part, the vast majority of these judges believe in the law. Not all, but certainly the ones in this district. You know, are going to be are going to see the law as somewhat sacrosanct.
They're going to ban a Wilmer Paul Weiss partner from a federal building. Call their bluff on that. Are you joking? If they're representing a certain client in federal court, what is like the threats, as she was saying, as Rachel was saying, are so, I feel like, easily stood up against if these major firms with billions of dollars in profit and billing stood alongside one another.
It's very disturbing, and that's where we're at. And tomorrow we're going to be talking to some folks from a public interest law firm about cases that they're bringing. And we're also going to be talking about the assault on our payment system. Because this is a multifaceted sort of assault on our government. We'll go into the fun half. It probably won't be so much fun. We're going to be talking about the HHS firings, talk a little bit about the tariffs and how people should understand these tariffs. And I'll just say this briefly because we're on the free half and I want people to understand this. They're claiming that it's going to raise $600 billion a year. Let's just take it at face value. Let's assume these tariffs do. Understand that that's $600 billion a year. They're projecting it out 10 years, which of course is absurd because it may be a different president. There may be a Congress that actually is willing to sort of say, no, you can't have these tariffs. But let's just take these assumptions for granted. Understand when they say this, there's two things that are happening. Assuming these tariffs stay in effect, they're going to use the supposed revenue over the next 10 years, $6 trillion, as a way of computing their budget plans, which will include trillions of dollars of tax cuts. So on one hand, you're taking revenue from the U.S. government in tax cuts. On the other hand, in their mind, you're adding revenue in the form of tariffs, which are also basically taxes.
Regressive taxes.
But the difference is The tax cuts are going to the wealthiest, and the tariffs are regressive. The cost of that car going up 25%, or your avocados going up 25%, or it doesn't matter. We'll feel it across the board. Impacts somebody making $40,000 a year, impacts somebody making $70,000 a year, impacts somebody making $100,000 a year, much more than someone who makes $700,000 a year, $2 million a year, $5 million, a billion, whatever. Understand, these tariffs are a redistribution of money from people with less money to people with more money.
Yep.
That's it.
Right.
Government always redistributes money. Always. Every action it takes, you can see as a redistribution. The only question is, which direction is it going in?
And Trump doesn't have to worry about going through Congress to raise taxes on the poorest and the middle class because he can just do it through the tariff as a compounding.
But why? Because
Chuck Schumer right.
allowed that Republican budget, dirty budget, to include a provision where Congress no longer has the authority to roll back those tariffs.
Yep, made it unilateral for Donald Trump.
We won't rest.
It's insane.
We won't rest. We won't rest. We won't rest. We won't rest.
You can only say it four times.
Yeah, time for a nap.
There'll be a little disturbance, but we're okay with that. It won't be much.
Folks, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member, join the majorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, but you also get the fun half. Also, justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee. That's why they call it Just Coffee. They also have hot chocolate. They used to have more stuff, but it's Just Coffee because they're just. Get the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Matt.
Tonight, Left Reckoning, 7 o'clock Eastern time. Same sort of topics we're talking about today. I have Chip Gibbons of Defending Rights and Dissent, which is one of my favorite sort of rights defense organizations, talking about the Gaza protests. Also, we'll talk about the war crimes related to Signalgate and that sort of stuff. So check that out. Patreon.com/Left Reckoning to get the postgame.
Pete Scott's breath. I just wanted to tell you that whatever that link was that you sent us, it broke our system. Do not send us big, long links.
You ruined the IM.
You have literally...
We can't read any of this crap.
Broke the IM. Do not send us extended links. Make sure they're tiny links, not ones that are literally...
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Now we
can't read any of this.
I know it.
Probably shouldn't be telling people how to break our chat, but anyway.
Well, there you go. We got to get that fixed. See you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
You. What is up, everyone? Nomi Keen.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this, 7A?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is it?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you?
no sound every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go start watching.
Who libertarians?
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this.
Poop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Did you do this thing right down here? Okay. Why don't you read a couple IMs? Can you read the IMs?
We will see. Oh, my goodness.
It makes it trickier.
Serious question. It would be irresponsible for you. Okay. So did PBD send a private jet, says Vat of? gosh, this is hard. Okay. Where else but Majority Report can you hear an ancient Chuck Schumer attempting to lead a rousing chant, says Snarkonorski.
We will win! We will win! We will win! We will win!
We will win. Here... Ember says, positive news. Friend in the Susan Crawford camp in Milwaukee says things look positive. Lots of Dem support.
Let me take a quick phone call because I'm anticipating a call here. Calls are still not open. However, I believe, were you calling from a 509 area code?
Hey, this is Ronald Reagan.
Ronald Reagan, what a coincidence. Good to hear from you. What's going on in your world of immigration? Things seem bad.
Mostly just wanted to call to say, like, Christy Noem's doing great. Everyone's doing awesome. ICE rules. And that's it.
So. Oh, that's not what we expected to hear from you.
Trying not to go to jail, right?
Yes. well done.
Yeah, so...
Let me ask you this, because we just had an attorney on, and we were talking about this briefly, and then I want to get to what you were talking about. How much concern is there within the immigration attorney community, is there? I mean, I know you are not the only immigration attorney I know. And most of them are, you know, maybe they'll have a small firm or they're a single practitioner, you know, obviously, and they don't necessarily have the resources to worry about, I don't know, getting sanctioned or going to jail. What is it like? What's the level of anxiety amongst not only immigrants, but immigration attorneys?
Yeah, I'd say it's pretty high. I mean, people are just amongst, like, my friends and stuff, you know, wondering, like, do we need to have plans to not live in this country? You know, sort of having those types of discussions. And it seems, on the one hand, hyperbolic, and then on the other hand, like maybe not. I mean, I don't know if you remember during the first Trump administration, they charged this guy with alien harboring because he was leaving water in the desert.
Yes.
And so the alien harboring statute is very broad, and they've, you know, the idea that they would try and exploit it isn't, you know, doesn't seem fantastical anymore. I think they would likely do something what they've done with these larger law firms, go after a couple of big names or whatever. I mean, obviously, like I'm really pro ICE, and so I don't think I'm a huge target because I think they're like awesome and sick at their jobs.
Right. Well known.
But like other well known, I'm pretty much like famous for that. But
I was going to say thank you for that pro ICE swag you sent us. That was very sweet of you.
Yeah, I'm just trying to promote awareness about like how much they rule and are awesome at doing, you know, ICE stuff. But no, I mean, it is concerning. And I mean, honestly, like one of the other big problems is that just even after the election, a lot of attorneys were saying, like, I'm done doing removal defense. It's too stressful. I'm burnt out. You know, I can't handle the uncertainty of it all. And so a lot of people were already sort of tapping out of, you know, the most sort of taxing part of the job. And so right now with detentions being ramped up and everything, you know, they're just, it's hard to even find a lawyer. So that's one of the big problems. I wanted to talk a little bit about gangs, I guess.
Yeah.
And, you know, everything that's going on with that. You know, one thing that's hard is that gang membership can be, you know, I know there's like formal ways to be jumped into a gang. There's ways to like definitely be part of a gang, but there's also a lot of people who maybe from ages like 14 to 18, because of where they live or because of their family or, you know, whatever the circumstances, they just have like a lot of friends that are in gangs.
Yes. Reagan, I'm not sure if you listened to the beginning of the show, but I was talking about this a little bit. Basically, the usage of tactics that have been used on folks in this country, oftentimes black people, where you're put into gang databases and black people and people of color are disproportionately represented. It's really difficult to get off of them. It's very obscure as to how you get on them at all. And it's usually just used to elevate charges against younger men who are either black or Latino or whatever to further mass incarceration. This is now just being used to deport people without due process.
Right. Yeah. So it's a real problem. And even just, you know, the process of trying to rehabilitate somebody who has had serious gang affiliation, I mean, that, like you're saying, that sort of sticks with them, you know, forever. And then there's all kinds of other complicated issues, like the fact that prison basically is like a gang culture. So there are people who go to prison and maybe they've been in a gang and they would really like to not be, but the very first thing that they have to do when they get into prison is prove loyalty to like one gang or the other. Like I've heard this story a million times.
And right.
So the first thing they're told when they get to prison is you can stab someone or we'll stab you. And you need to show us like right this second, you know, you've got 5 minutes to do this, you know, who you're rolling with or whatever. And so it gets messy from the guy who like hung out with a gang for 6 months because he was trying to like get some street cred or whatever, and that was 10 years ago, to somebody who maybe was like a hardcore gang member and they're trying to not be. And our society is already like really shitty at sort of parsing those things and allowing people to to change. But one of the stories that came out last night was that we deported somebody to El Salvador who was granted withholding which is a form of relief that's included in the asylum application. And withholding is technically harder to win than asylum because you have to show a likelihood of persecution.
If you go back, right. And this is a guy who was who came here because he was being threatened by El Salvadoran gangs.
Right. And right. So the idea that you would win withholding, which means like it's more likely than not that you'll be persecuted. And on top of that, the government is unable or unwilling to protect you. And the idea that we would roll somebody up and send them not just back to the country, because like if you got sent to El Salvador and you landed at the airport, like maybe you could hide for a while and like escape or, you know, whatever. But to turn that person over to the government that you fear, and then to be placed into like a torture camp with the other people that you fear, is shocking. Like it's totally shocking. And on top of that, the response, I mean, if the response is anything less than, holy shit, we fucked up, we got to get this guy back, that's what really concerns me. Because there's all kinds of people with withholding, and now they're looking at this thinking, you know, we're not safe here.
Just ask you a brief question. If you were pursuing some form of legal residence right now as an immigrant, would you continue pursuing legal residency, or are you then putting yourself on ICE's radar?
It's kind of a complicated question, but I think like if you have a form of relief available to you, then you should be pursuing it for sure. You know, the alternative is doing nothing and like
waiting.
The idea that like you're not on their radar already, I think is usually a delusion. They know where most people are, and the people who think they're hiding usually have given their information to the government in like 10 other ways. But it also depends. I mean, there's some ways you can legalize that are maybe risky, or the argument's, you know, a little bit of a stretch, and those are going to be individualized determinations. But I wanted to say one last thing about ICE, and sorry for taking so much time, but, you know, some people are looking at this like they're malicious, and I think they are, but from my experience, and I don't know that this matters, it's like a distinction without a difference, but I think they're malicious in that they don't care about how sloppy and bad they are at their job. From what I've seen, a lot of ICE agents don't know the law that well. They don't take notes. They don't record what they're doing. So we've had, I mean, these are like anecdotes, but somebody who was doing check-ins with ICE, and they were granted a visa, so they were allowed to be here. And I called the office. I mailed copies of the approval. The client went in with their work permit, which shows they have a visa. And the officer was like, that's not a visa, that's just a work permit. Well, it's proof that they were granted a visa, but they don't know the law. And they kept being told they had to continue checking in. So finally I went in person and I was like, this is the fourth time I've had to bring these documents to you guys. And the officer pulled up the notes. There were no notes. And so, I mean, there's all kinds of critiques of like policing, obviously. We don't have to get into that. But if a cop is like fucking with his breathalyzer, like every case he's ever done gets thrown out. Like there's consequences. He can be dragged before the court. Forced to testify under oath, and like I know they lie and we can get whatever, but there are like real consequences. And for ICE, there's just nothing. Like they don't have to record what they're doing. Even the data sharing within the agency is super shitty. So like you can have a case granted in court, there's an ICE attorney sitting there in court who knows about the withholding. And the local ICE office that does the enforcement, the door kicking and all that shit, they might have no idea.
Right.
Because the attorney in court hasn't left a note.
But also, Reagan, like, these ICE prosecutors seem to be complicit in this, too. Did you read that Texas Observer story from a few weeks ago about how this Dallas ICE prosecutor literally is behind a white supremacist account on Twitter? I mean, it seems like the entire system, it's a cycle of just, like, everybody accepting a complete violation of rights from the prosecutor to the agents to now the administration and probably even the judges in many of these instances.
Well, I love the judges.
I forgot. Yes, sorry.
But two examples real quick from Seattle, because I worked in the Pacific Northwest. There was an ICE prosecutor named Jonathan Love. You can look this up. He got convicted because he went to court. It was like a regular guy. It wasn't like a pedophile he was trying to put away. Not that that would be justified, but like a regular guy trying to apply for release so he could stay in the country with his family. And this guy forged a document saying, oh, no, he's been deported at the border, you know, 8 years ago. So he's ineligible. He's ineligible for relief. It went up on appeal. And finally, like a third attorney reviewed this case and said, hey, this is a DHS document, the removal order, from before DHS existed. So this is clearly a forgery. And sure enough, it was a forgery. And the guy, you know, went to jail, lost his job. But they never did an audit of his work. They never went back to say, like,
you don't think it's likely that was the one time he decided to do it? He was highly motivated in that one case, and he decided to forge that thing?
Well, yeah, trust me. I've had clients try and say that in court that their DUI was the first time they ever drove under the influence, and the judges will immediately roll their eyes and deny their case.
Right.
Because they're clearly lying. Of course it wasn't the first time, but for Jonathan Love, that was enough. And then, last example, and then I'll go, but the chief counsel, the head of the ICE attorneys, this is a few years later, went to jail for 4 years because he was stealing immigrant identities, making fake documents in their name and taking out credit cards and, you know, opening bank accounts and all this shit in the names of the immigrants he was deporting. He was ordered to pay $190,000 in restitution. And same thing, it got totally swept under the rug. Like, he went to jail, they did their little thing, but no, like, further investigation or anything like that. So, yeah, I mean, it's just rotten to the core, the whole thing. Other than the ones that, like, I work with, they're awesome.
Right. But all the people in the Pacific Northwest are great, but it's the rest of the country.
Yeah.
Ronald Reagan, thanks. Appreciate the call. We're going to clip this and get it out there. Appreciate it.
On that note, this isn't on the sound sheet, but Jessica Burbank of Drop Site News and Jess and John pod with John Russell did a Christy Noem impression, and let's just play a little bit of this if you can cut to this.
Oh, Russ. My God.
She this already looks Jessica disturbing. Did. I haven't seen this, but she did her makeup exactly right. Well done.
There are consequences for being illegal. This is one of the tools in our toolkit that we will use when terrorists come here. Don't come here, but when terrorists come here illegally. Hey, are you sure you want to say terrorist? They had tattoos. Okay, let's go again. But no, that if you come here illegally, you could end up in one of these facilities. Okay. If you don't want to end up here, try not being so Mexican. Ma'am, this is El Salvador. I know. Not Mexico. Hang on, Jeff.
That's fantastic.
I literally thought it was Noam.
She did her hair. Instagram. I mean,
she's wearing the same outfit.
Same outfit. I love the commitment.
Obviously, if you are listening to us and you're in Wisconsin and you have not voted for Crawford in this Supreme Court race, pause us on whatever device you're listening and go and vote, or take us with you and go and vote. It is a very, very important election. Same too, if you're in the first or sixth district in Florida, go vote. These votes are going to have a just a lot more resonance. Again, we need every sort of like tool in the toolkit, as it were, to slow the roll of the Trump administration. And a win in Wisconsin, despite Elon Musk's money, and a win in Florida, or even like a close margin, is going to scare some of these Republican lawmakers. Will it change their behavior? Probably not. But it's going to get closer to changing their behavior. It may mean all they need Trump to fall in favorability is a point or two less than they would have otherwise. Maybe consumer confidence will shake them. I mean, all of these things. And right now, Elon Musk has been camping out in Wisconsin. On Sunday, there's another clip. He's out in front of the big patent flag that he has from that movie Patent. I don't know why he does that, but it makes him seem like he...
I'm an American.
Oh, really American.
Can't you tell if you have it on mute?
They have been out and out lying about Social Security. They want to cut Social Security. They know they can't unless they pretend there's huge amounts of fraud and waste in it. We already know the facts on this. The facts are that 1% of payments have been found to be what they call inappropriate payments. 2/3 of those payments are clawed back over the course of the year. 1/3 probably lost the fraud. It is a tiny amount. There's probably more fraud in the money they spent on this production in Wisconsin. I would have bet you there's more fraud and waste in just putting on that show that they do there. There's certainly fraud. And here is some of the fraud right now. They are lying about Social Security numbers. They are talking about, they're pretending they're talking about undocumented immigrants. They are talking about people with legal status in this country.
I think so. Does it work? I can give you mine.
We found the fraud. Here it comes. Oh, this is, he's on the stage. Keep it going.
It'll be okay.
Antonio Garcia.
I mean, Garcia's. Buzz Aldrin's still alive, and he went past the belts.
And work. Is this working? Yeah, it's on now. Yeah,
there you go. So, Antonio, can you tell us what you, Antonio's helping out with Social Security. So just trying to review Social Security, where you may have heard that we found 20 million dead people marked as alive in the Social Security database. This is so crazy.
Pause it.
And then...
We've already debunked this.
This is completely a fabrication. It is a lie. They're not marked alive. No. How did you find those 20? Where did you find those 20? Or did you say like, oh, they're 150 years old. They're obviously not alive. These are not people, incidentally, who get payments. There's just like no reason to go and pull them out and expend resources on that.
And the 150-year-old thing that they keep returning to is Elon being just lying. He's lying to the public because he has some familiarity with coding. He's not the greatest, but he has some familiarity. And COBOL, when there is an incomplete data and missing with the year that is in the input, they put that set year, which
they
makes
default to like 1875 or something.
They default to that year, which he's now claiming is instances of people receiving fraudulent Social Security checks, even though that's quite obviously not what the data system says.
So that's why he's very careful to say there's 20 million dead people in the system, but he doesn't claim they're getting payments. So he knows he's lying.
Yeah.
But he continues on.
So crazy. And then you'll notice there's a strange trend here where how many
Social Security numbers were issued. Okay. All right. Now, they're going to show that there were more Social Security numbers issued in 2024 than in 2021, when we weren't letting legal residents into the country, when nobody was traveling into the country because of, what was that? COVID.
Global pandemic. I forgot remember about that?
Yeah. You may have heard that we found 20 million dead people marked as alive in the Social Security database. So. This is so crazy. And then you'll notice there's a strange trend here where how many Social Security numbers were issued. Do you want to?
Yeah, so let me tell you what happened here. We started at the top of the system.
You want to talk about a lot of me.
We started at the top of the system, mapping the whole system of Social Security to understand where all the fraud was. And there's a lot of great people there that showed us really a lot of waste. And so that came up with a big list of stuff they're working on. You've heard some of that already. But this is what jumped out at us. When we saw these numbers, we were like, what is this? In 21, you see 270,000 people, goes all the way to 2.1 million in 24. These are non-citizens that are getting Social Security numbers.
Yeah, this is a mind-blowing chart.
Yeah, just
pause it. I just want to be very clear here. Non-citizens does not equal undocumented immigrants or illegal immigrants. There is something in between. That is people with green cards. That is people who are here on temporary work visas.
How about H-1B visas like Trump and Elon Musk?
They are not citizens, but they must pay taxes. They're not eligible to get things like Social Security, but they've got to pay taxes. So it's a complete, that graph shows is free money for the government.
In fact, you could argue that these folks are helping, fund Social Security in ways that like actually it has delayed what we've needed to do, which is to raise/eliminate the cap on taxable income so that wealthy people start to pay their fair share to replenish the trust fund.
It's free money.
Yes.
It's free money.
Actually,
they pay taxes.
Immigrants are helping billionaires not pay more in or millionaires into Social Security.
And the Social Security numbers that they get are issued through a specific program where they can't get money back for those Social Security payments. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is a mind-blowing chart.
Yeah,
just get a good look at that chart, folks, because we're going to take a wider view of it in a second.
This literally blew us away. Like, we went there to find fraud, and we found this by accident. And this isn't political, by the way. My parents are immigrants. This
is stupid as you.
My brother and sister all born in Spain. I'm pro legal immigration. This is not political. This is not political.
Oh,
this is about
God.
America.
Oh my God. This is, there are such unreconstructed liars. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable.
Make it easier to
either these guys are the stupidest people alive, or they are just impressively just willing to lie in the same way that you and I breathe.
It's got to be the latter.
Go ahead.
America and the future of America. And there are a lot of good people in the system that pointed this in this direction. I want to honor them right now that work in the government today, who took risks to show us these numbers and tell us what's going on.
Yeah.
So I want to stop for a minute. I want to honor those people today. Very good people. Very good people. I have been from D.C. to Social Security offices to the border to track this down, and very good people have helped us along the way. I want to thank them.
You know where they could have gone? You didn't have to go to D.C. or all the way to the border or go to any of these places. Here, I'm going to show them where they could have gone. It is called, this link right here, it's called the Social Security Administration website. And they could look up a program called the EBE, which is the Enumeration Beyond Entry.
Yep.
Under the Enumeration Beyond Entry agreement between the Social Security Administration and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, DHS, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, the USCIS, USCIS provides Social Security Administration with information necessary to enumerate certain aliens, that means non-citizens, who live in the United States who request a Social Security number or a replacement card. And it goes through the whole application process. And this is an existing program so that people who are eligible to work in this country can pay taxes.
Right. Right. He's conflating the approval of a Social Security number for legal immigrants with receiving Social Security benefits.
And that is fraud.
As if it's fraud. They're paying taxes. They should be receiving benefits, but that's a part of our broken immigration system.
And it's like the opposite of fraud.
Right.
And speaking
it's
of
like we're frauding the
with graphs. Hold on. Make sure you do the comparison. Put up the other one, because this looks like, I got to say, I'm looking at this graph and I'm thinking to myself, oh my gosh, what is leading to this huge explosion? This looks just like almost like a crime graph, weirdly, but why would it explode from 2021? Oh, look at that.
Oh, huh.
We had immigration going around just like this, basically static from 2016.
Trump.
And then we had COVID for 3 years and pent up essentially a number of people who wanted to come. Frankly, what's shocking is that 2024 doesn't make up for
right.
those 2021 and 2020. Keep it up there. Like, we should be seeing those missing immigrants in 2021, those missing immigrants in 2022, and those missing immigrants in 2023 added to 2024. And all it looks like is now just a nominal bump from where it was through the teens leading up to that. But they are lying.
They know this.
They are purposely lying.
Yeah, they know this.
They know the H-1B visa holders that they employ, and they defended that program. They get SSNs.
Right. And in part.
But they're 150 years old.
The idea that they're basically trying to push again immigrants and people here back into the shadows and even under the threat of more like deportation and punitive actions, because people who are here with legal status who were approved and who apply for Social Security numbers, it's because they literally want to pay taxes. They want to pay taxes because they hope that basically this would mean that this builds up their equity so that they can apply for full citizenship later on. And the Trump administration is using that against them to claim that they are people who are defrauding Social Security, or in the instances of what we're seeing with El Salvador and with the pro-Palestine demonstrators who are being deported, their legal status doesn't protect them, and they're getting rid of them altogether. These are people that tried to do everything the right way.
But they're dead.
Right.
This is actually an amazing graph. What I love about this is, like, and I don't know who the Gracias is, the other guy there, but their whole sort of way of speaking that has been like the main dominant way of like, oh, this is how an intelligent person or industry leader talks. And they're just spewing the most transparent bullshit.
Right.
Ooh, I went to the border and to DC on this fact finding mission, and I was surprised what I found. You're full of shit.
Yeah. Also, didn't they make fun of AOC for going to the border and like, you know, having some emotional reaction?
Well, that
to
was
it.
Empathy. They were doing logic.
They were there
at
for
the
fascism.
But absolute
matters,
liars.
Yeah.
Absolute liars. And why are they lying about the fraud? You've got to ask yourself, why are they lying about the fraud and waste in Social Security? Yeah. They're lying about the fraud and waste in Social Security because they're going to come and try and cut it.
Same reason they're saying everyone's trend to Aragua.
Speaking of Elon Musk lying about fraud and waste in Social Security as a beginning of a pathway to cut Social Security. And I lived through post 9/11, and I watched how an administration tried to create a narrative that we had to go and invade Iraq. And it took like 2 years. And this is what they do. They create this sense of like, we're only here to do fraud and waste. Whoa, I went into Social Security and there's a tremendous amount of fraud and waste. And we know this is not the case.
Yep.
We know it's not the case. But they're going to come up with lie after lie after lie because ultimately their agenda is to cut Social Security. And they have the exact same agenda with Medicare.
Yep.
Because Social Security and Medicare, it's essentially like outside of our military, it is what the government does. It provides things like food assistance and helps with education and funds libraries and whatnot, although increasingly less because the Trump administration is cutting all these services. You know, make sure you have healthy food and clean air, et cetera, et cetera. But largely, it's Social Security and Medicare. And so the Republicans have been coming after this since the day each one of those programs started.
Yep.
You can look in the 1936 platform of the Republican Party, cut Social Security, get rid of it. Within the first year, because they said this is socialism. We don't want it. Medicare came after Medicare immediately.
Yep.
Here is Senator John Cassidy.
Bill Cassidy.
Bill Cassidy. Sorry. I'm thinking of Kennedy. And Cassidy is a doctor. Isn't he a doctor?
Yeah.
He was the one who pretended like he was concerned about
RFK.
Bobby Kennedy essentially, you know, letting measles run rampant across the country.
Oh, but he bowed his little head, a good little head, too.
And
voted to confirm him.
Well, I think in psychological parlance, you call this a Freudian slip.
Yes.
But, I mean, let's be honest. Like, why do the dance when you can just be honest about it?
Well, he's an old school Republican. He thinks of himself more highly.
Spare lots of money. Let's bring that approach not to just what DOGE is doing, discretionary spending, but let's look at Medicare. Is there some
pause
way
for a
that
second.
We can
okay,
cut
now
Medicare
he's saying
so
he's going in and looking, he's saying DOGE is going into discretionary spending. That is every year when there's a budget, Congress decides how much money are we going to give to people who are hungry, or how much money are we going to give to schools that need support, or FDA, FCC, FAA, I mean, on and on and on. Non-discretionary spending is Medicare and Social Security because they support themselves. But they want to cut that. They want to get in there because they have borrowed money against these funds. And they don't want to pay it back. They want to give it away in tax cuts to rich people.
They do not like that as a part of mandatory spending, Social Security and Medicare are funded via the payroll tax and statutorily cannot be touched. So this entire project is like they don't want to just be able to cut from discretionary. They want to be able to tap into that protected lockbox, as John Kerry said. I think it was Kerry.
Al Gore,
sorry.
Bring that approach not to just what DOGE is doing, discretionary spending, but let's look at Medicare. Is there some way that we can cut Medicare so that it's, excuse me, reform Medicare so that benefits stay the same, but that it's less expensive, more?
Is there some way that we can cut Medicare so that benefits stay the same and we save money? Well, there is. It's on the provider side, but the best way to do that is to expand Medicare to everybody. If you're looking for efficiency, the most efficient thing that we can do with Medicare and healthcare in this country, and you can go and check out the Mercatus think tank, which is a libertarian think tank. They ran the numbers on this. It would involve more government spending and less private spending. And we would, dollar for dollar, citizen for citizen, we would spend a lot less on healthcare if we went to a single payer system. They'll never do this. And so they're going to go in and we're doing cuts and it's all to providers. But there's two ways you can cut with providers. One is you can say, we're putting a cap on how much this is going to cost. Or the other is you can say, like, we're no longer allowing you to get this procedure under Medicare, and you're going to have to get Medicare Advantage and privatize it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's the way they'll offload it. Well, they'll force you into private health insurance.
Or they just do future cuts where that isn't that what his the coded language is that they don't want this necessarily the current senior population to feel the cuts, but that there's going to have to be something that's done about future generations so that they can make it. It's delayed release.
Yep.
Want to watch him smile again after he realizes what he's saying?
Can we play the whole slip again? It was pretty brazen.
Get Medicare. Is there some way that we can cut Medicare so that it's, reform Medicare so that benefits stay the same, but that it's less expensive, more efficient?
Reform.
I would say that there is, and that's where our opportunity lies.
Mm. So you agree with all of those tax cuts and tax plans, and you think it can all be paid for just with efficiency that we find in other areas of the government?
Are you
joking? I'm going to say I agree with them all. If we're going to extend present policy as current baseline, just to go into procedures, I want to pay for that. Figure out how to pay for it. It's really good to make things permanent, but you got to be able to live within your means. And so
there was an idea of
that.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, sir.
Because
live within your means.
They never tell their donors that.
Yeah.
No.
Should Elon Musk live within his means? Jesus Christ. Can that follow-up just be like, hey, what did you just say?
This understand what they're doing now is that they're trying to figure out how they're going to justify huge tax cuts for the wealthy. And one of them is going to be they're going to use the supposed revenue from tariffs, which I'm happy to stipulate that that money's going to come in. It's not going to do the job that it's supposed to do, but that money's going to come in. And it's all going to come at the expense of a higher percentage of low-income people's money. If you have $40,000 a year and that car bumps up 25%, it's going to take a bigger chunk out of your paycheck to pay for that car. If you're a millionaire, it don't make a difference to you.
Yep.
And so they're going to use that revenue, that projected revenue from tariffs, as a way of offsetting tax cuts for rich people. The other thing they're going to do, and they're trying to do this right now, Senate Republicans, the way that the budget works, you have Trump's tax cuts, which are due to expire, I think it's in 2026. That's happening. That's what the law is. Those tax cuts go away. The Republicans want to pretend that they're not going to go away so that the baseline of revenue stays where it's at. Because the baseline of revenue is supposed to go up because the tax cuts are expiring. But if they keep the baseline of revenue here, down here, it doesn't look like when they cut taxes that they're actually cutting that much. So taxes are supposed to go up this much. And when they give tax cuts down to here, they're going to have to justify all those huge tax cuts. But if they pretend that actually the tax level is here, they're only doing a tiny cut on taxes. And they're trying to hide that. And right now they're trying to negotiate with their parliamentarian. And I get the sense that they're thinking that they're going to lose this argument because they're already starting to float the notion of like, well, maybe the parliamentarian isn't supposed to rule on this. Maybe it's the budget chair, Lindsey Graham, who will rule on this.
Oh, my God. I wish we could go back and talk when in Democratic administrations and see one Democrat even approach making the case, that case, that the Democratic majority budget or the leader of the budget.
Senate Finance Committee,
who would be a Democrat in that instance, has the ability to override the parliamentarian.
John Cornyn says the Republicans are discussing whether Senate Budget Chair Lindsey Graham can, quote, basically say under his authority what the baseline is. So you can't, like, you know, if the baseline's low and you cut taxes even lower, it's going to look like you're not really doing that much tax cuts for the rich.
Whatever. I mean, can the Republicans just, like, completely eschew the parliamentarians so that the Democrats don't have this excuse the next goddamn time around?
The parliamentarian will decide whether he has that authority, and it's unclear whether they will ignore the parliamentarian on that question, too.
You got to wonder, what the hell is the point of the parliamentarian? And
to make sure the House wins.
Yeah.
What else we got here?
Oh, should we get to Lindell? We haven't talked about this, or we could do Ezra.
Let's do. Which do you prefer?
I don't know.
Let's do Lindell, and then we'll do Ezra.
What?
It's been a long time. I have to say, like the other day, I was thinking, what happened to that guy?
Yeah.
Because they kept him under wraps, and now he's emerging from his slumber.
It's his time.
Is he going to get a cabinet election?
I mean, I'm pretty impressed that he's still...
That he hasn't.
Like, that he's, like, still alive and kicking. It really oh, yeah. didn't look like for a while that he was... had run out of, like, you know, runway, essentially.
Right.
But, ladies and gentlemen, is MyPillow, is that completely out of business now? Or MyPillow, Mike Lindell?
Well, I don't see any coupon codes on the screen Which right now, so shocking. That's not a good sign.
That's not a good sign. But this is on Lindell TV. And
great graphic design for Lindell
he
TV.
He is making a big announcement.
Of the state of Minnesota, because right now we have a voice that could be big enough where when I do my due diligence and we're going to do polling, we're going to get a couple different polls to be taken. We're going to be doing, you do all kinds of due diligence. I'm just checking into all this now. But they're saying, well, why would you consider it now and you didn't consider
it?
Pause it
for 1 second. We should say he starts us off by saying that he is considering a run for governor.
Against
in
Tim
Minnesota.
Walz.
But I love this how, like, first of all, I love how the lunatics who are on the camera with him are all nodding like, yeah, of course.
Duh.
I'm sure the polling's going to be massive. I'm sure the polling's going to be through the roof for this guy.
I mean, you see that John Ossoff keeps trying to push Marjorie Taylor Greene to run for Senate. I don't know if you've been seeing this, but he's been kind of like doing little digs at her to goad her into doing it because he's more afraid of Brian Kemp, who has more popularity in Georgia. But Tim Walz should be doing this with Mike Lindell. Like, I'm the most afraid of Mike Lindell, right?
Check the subtle side eye from Vanessa Broussard here.
Due diligence. I'm just checking into all this now, but they're saying, well, why would you consider it now and you didn't consider it then? Because we got our voice back, and all the lies that Walz is putting out can be, we will see through them. It won't just be me saying it, or we're saying it on Lindell TV. The whole world will be screaming it, that these lies will be uncovered, you know. And what are they going to do? You know, well, Mike Lindell, you know he was a crack addict. Yeah. What else you got?
Hold on, pause it for a second. Pause it. Emma, I got to ask you, this is a little off topic. Was this what it was like when Cenk said he was running? Like, did you have to go, I can't run, and be like,
No, this is a great idea. Well, the congressional run, why I was not opposed to that. The presidential run might be close to Mike Lindell's level of delusion here.
What are you going to do? You know, well, Mike Lindell, you know he was a crack addict. Yeah. What else you got?
Yeah.
So there you have it.
What else could you get? What else? What else is there? Okay.
The rest of your public output?
Every single other
Think
moment
about you? Yeah.
You've been on TV.
Every
since
impression I've ever had
like,
of you.
Like
honestly, the crack addict thing is the least controversial part about Mike Lindell.
Slightly humanized.
Yeah, exactly. Everything else. There's everything else. The entire insistence of stuff that like got your compatriots disbarred, that got you sued, the Dominion suit. Like, I mean, everything else. The fact that you got banned from every other right-wing network, so you had to start your own?
The fact that Trump didn't give you a cabinet selection or a nomination, I mean...
No, cross your fingers.
Everybody else is, like, he's too crazy for the Trump cabinet.
What else you got?
I got my voice back.
All right, well, that okay, besides all that...
He was a crack addict. Yeah? What else you got? So there you have it. Rick, I kind of surprised you with that. I am considering it, and I'm going to do due diligence over these. As we roll out this, I'm going to make some bigger announcements tomorrow.
Announcements? What is the what is the bigger announcement that he's
I'm going to save a bigger announcement for April Fool's Day.
Oh, Also, what about that thing with the computer? He got sued. He basically said, like, what was it that he had? He made a challenge to his audience.
Oh, yes.
About,
about it was like a financial reward.
Crunching the numbers on fraud.
Yeah.
And somebody in his audience was like, oh, I'm a statistician or a computer person. I'll do that. And he offered $1 million. And $5 million.
Judge says Mike Lindell must pay $5 million to man who won his prove Mike wrong challenge.
And then Lindell wouldn't pay, but he ultimately had to.
All you've got him is I'm a crack addict.
I'm going to make some bigger announcements tomorrow, and hopefully that the we'll find out that the polling will do and all this stuff will show. I think it's going to show. I live here in Minnesota. Everywhere I go, nobody wants Tim Walz. They don't.
Polling's going to show you live in Minnesota?
Oh, my gosh.
Please. Please, Ron.
Did he learn the word due diligence in all those lawsuits? And now he just can't stop using it?
Exactly. Exactly. I also like letting the cat out of the bag. I'm going to do polling. Like, it's literally, I'm going to see if I'm already elected to be governor.
I'm going to see if they know about
and
the crack.
And if I am, I'm going to serve as governor.
Yeah, it's like you could see he doesn't know what the next word is going to be as he speaks the first word.
All they got, except for all that other stuff.
Yeah. I'd say maybe next time you do an announcement like that, write it out so you don't have to keep saying, like, the due diligence.
Due diligence. I'm just going to check and see if I have any chance. Probably I do. But if there's a chance that I'm polling, if I'm polling anything lower than zero, I won't run.
He's like just polling his first super chats or something.
And honestly, if I poll at 1%, I feel like I can build on that. MyPillow must not exist anymore because he went through that whole segment without a coupon code. It does exist.
Let's go to the website MyPillow.com.
Maybe he doesn't own it. Maybe it's owned by Dominion now.
That would be funny. Oh, gosh, he's all over the branding. A pop-up. Save up to 80% off. Oy.
Sam, Mike Lindell sounds kind of like Alex Jones. Well, it's because he does. My Alex Jones is just slightly more guttural.
My pillow owned by election denier Mike Lindell, formerly evicted from Minnesota warehouse.
I'm selling him out of my car.
Trying to get his trunk closed.
Coupon code, close my trunk. I've got to move 4 pillows. Right now, 85% off. So I can
see through my rear view window.
Yes. Thank God I got a Bronco. Oh my God. I didn't do my due diligence on my trunk. I thought I could fit 45 pillows in there. Well, it turns out I can fit 38.
I'm going to pull off to this rest stop, try to sell some quick.
This is one of the scams. I'm also, like, they say the trunk was 32 cubic feet, and it's not. Oh, gosh.
Oh.
God, Mike Lindell, please run.
I know. Please.
Please, please, please. Please. I beg you. Actually, you know what? I honestly feel like enough people emailed Mike Lindell to run.
Yes, actually.
Honestly,
I was going to do polling, but then I just got so many emails. I said, what are the chances?
After you're done calling your senator to tell them to stop fascism or
please,
whatever, go call Mike Lindell.
Literally, people should email. I have a message from God. He's selling crosses on his website, too, that said that you are the one to save our great state of Minnesota. Mike, God has told me that you are can be our vessel going forward. People need to do that. We need it.
I did that to Gary Busey. It was one of the most successful things I've ever done.
And you know what? That, in terms of, like, analogous characters, they could totally work.
Totally. Very similar.
They're very similar people.
Very similar in disposition.
And I say that with all respect.
Speaking of respect, I sort of feel bad for Ezra Klein. Because I think there was, like, this expectation that Harris is going to win the election.
Yeah.
And this was going to be part of, like, the big neoliberal pushback on the success that Sanders and Warren had in pushing their agenda into the Biden administration, which was greater labor strength and a more robust antitrust regime that would undermine consolidated economic power, which, of course, also has translated into consolidated political power. And the way that I think, and I don't know that Ezra Klein was the, you know, I don't think he was the mastermind behind this. I think it was obviously, it's like, we can, you can go back and you can look, and it was like the Nicholson Institute and Cato, I think, was a little bit there. I mean, it's like it's the third way, neoliberal in the most specific way. The idea that the market will provide solutions for society if government is not in the way. And this is an ideology that was, you know, very, has been prominent for 40 years in this country. And then Harris doesn't win. And then, like, Klein, in many instances, his he hasn't engaged in sort of the politics in the same way that he had for years before. But his whole brand was to be a to provide analysis that was divorced of ideology and not influenced by political pressure.
Right.
And that shtick worked for a while until people started becoming aware, and people became more aware, and, you know, frankly, the terrain changed, where people started to understand, like, that supposed absence of ideology isn't in of itself an ideology.
It's not possible when you're talking about politics.
Well, also, the idea that any of this technical, you know, that supposed, like, policy stuff is divorced from politics is also silly. But, like, he has an ideology because he's not necessarily going in the way. And then there's also this question of, like, there's not many generalists like Klein. Like, he cut his teeth by becoming like the generalist expert at healthcare. That was what his big thing was in the run up to the ACA stuff. And it's like, you know, look, I know a lot about Social Security. But if I'm sitting next to someone who's worked on Social Security policy, they know more. But nobody's going to listen to that guy. That guy doesn't have a show.
Right.
That guy's not an op-ed columnist. And so this is sort of, there's a couple of, like, clips that are out there now of Klein, where one was where he was talking about the, with Jon Stewart, where he was talking about in the Inflation Reduction Act, there was a provision to expand broadband. And he goes on and on, like, there was so many roadblocks put up by the Democrats in that legislation that the Democrats have to get out of their way. And then one of Biden's national economic advisors goes, like, dude, that was the Republicans.
Yeah.
That was a concession we made to the Republicans to get this bill passed. Like, there's concurrent reporting that show That was what the ask was. Republicans are always, and they'll use regulation as a means to do it, but they're always putting roadblocks up there to prevent corporations from being directed to do stuff. And again, those corporations, incidentally, those cable outlets, what do they have in every region? It's a monopoly. And he would get away with that if we were in a different era where somebody couldn't hop on Twitter and go, there's reporting. And now John Stewart's not supposed to know that.
Right.
And here is another instance where he is on Crooked Media. He's being asked what is like not a necessarily like a particularly difficult question.
Although Favreau here does read a very good critique of this book by Zephyr Teachout, who is of the anti-monopolist wing that Sam just kind of described. Very much so. Ran for governor here in New York State is a good voice on this.
Well, she was a colleague of Tim Wu's, who was at one point working in the Biden administration in antitrust and whatnot. And she's also a professor of that as well.
You mentioned some of the critique from the left. I'm sure you've read all of it, or read most of it. I'm sure you've talked about the Zephyr Teachout review of Abundance. I wanted to get your reaction to one part of that because I think...
Pause. We should also just add, this is caught up by Crooked Media because there was like a... Good.
I think it summarizes a lot of the criticism on the left. I mean, you mentioned the Bernie side. There's also a Warren-esque critique as well. And she writes, I still can't tell after reading Abundance whether Klein and Thompson are seeking something fairly small bore and correct, we need zoning reform, or non-trivial and deeply regressive, we need deregulation, or whether there is room within Abundance for anti-monopoly politics and a more full-throated unleashing of American potential. Matt Brunig has a similar critique. He says it would be a huge mistake to sideline whatever focus there is on welfare state expansion and economic egalitarianism in favor of a focus on administrative burdens in construction. It's not a book about like monopolistic.
All right, pause it for one second. I just want to walk through what those critiques were. Largely, people have said, critics of it, of the left, of this book, that there are specific provisions in there that, sure, and I think, you know, anybody would concede there are good regulations and bad regulations. And having a, you know, evidence-based look at some of these regulations, definitely a worthwhile endeavor. Maybe some should be rolled back on local levels in specific areas. But to promote deregulation in and of itself is a upward redistribution of wealth. Regulations largely inhibit corporate profit making because they basically say, we're not going to allow you to socialize the costs.
Yeah.
And privatize the profits.
Right.
And so that was, you know, that like, Zephyr Teachout says, like, I can't tell if this book is meant to be a series of small reforms, which
are acceptable. Yes.
Why wouldn't you?
Yep.
I mean, Zoran and people say, like, hey, we should change regulations so we can build more housing in New York City.
Exactly. Or if it's supposed to be a larger ideological argument against deregulation, or if in this whole calculation of where the Democratic Party should go, if it's this big treaties, where does anti-monopolistic policy fit into this whole sort of milieu?
Yes. And that question, those final two, well, I think it gets answered by Klein and not in a great way in just a second. But I was more sympathetic to the idea that it was just kind of a small book. And I don't, you know, mean to be insulting in that way. But it's the branding of it and the promotion of it, because Klein is a big name, makes it sound like this is the roadmap for the Democrats in the future. Whereas, as Matt just pointed out, folks that are advocates for housing already incorporate these critiques into their vision for affordable housing in this country. But it is maybe, one or two paragraphs? It's a part of the whole. Because absent a repealing of, say, the Faircloth Amendment so that the federal government can fund public housing again, absent broad decommodification, absent going after the private equity firms that are buying up our housing, or the algorithms like RealPage that are artificially inflating rents so that housing is more unaffordable than it's ever been in this country. The part about cutting red tape that we all agree with is not going to have the desired effect. In fact, it may just further commodify housing and empower private interests to raise rents regardless of the supply. So it has to be paired with a vision that takes on corporate power. And so my kind of view of what he was arguing was, I don't know if Klein's hostile to what's being said there, but perhaps the book just, you know, is presented as if it's a bigger vision for the world than it actually is in practice. But the way he responds to Teachout's critique here makes me think that perhaps the instinct that some of us had might have been a bit too generous.
About like monopolistic power practices and corporate concentration. So I get that. I guess to the question that Teachout asked, is there room in abundance for a critique of concentrated economic power and anti-monopoly politics and all that?
I'm trying to think about the nicest way to say this. My friends in the whole problem is oligarchy part of the party. And I believe a good part of our problems are oligarchy. But there are certain kinds of problems they're then willing to see and certain kinds they're not as willing to see. Mm-hmm. So in housing, I find a lot of them get obsessed with this idea that private investors are buying up a bunch of rental housing. And this is an extremely small part of the market right now and is just not the main problem in housing. But because it is the villain they are comfortable having, it is where they want to put their focus. Kamala Harris, I was very excited when she brought out her big plan to build 3 million units of housing, but her plan never would have achieved anything like it. It did have a big thing about trying to do something about this private investor buying up housing issue, though. So you can really get, I think, taken off the track. A thing I found like really interesting in Zephyr's review was that, is it something good and small like zoning reform? And like, try doing zoning reform if you think it's small, right? Or something bad like deregulation. Okay, interesting, right?
Yeah.
Deregulation is a word that I think shuts liberals down a bit. And it shouldn't. A lot of what we're pointing out in the book is that the player that is often most regulated is not the market. It's the government itself. If you want to understand why the government can't build public housing effectively, I mean, in many ways, the federal government building public housing is now functionally illegal. It's been regulated out of possibility. If you want to know why we didn't build California high-speed rail, if you want to know why it's so expensive to build affordable housing in a lot of liberal jurisdictions when you trigger public money, it is because of the regulations we put on government.
Okay. Here's the point. Who's the we? He says that the oligarchy is not the problem. And what is an oligarchy? An oligarchy is people who have amassed so much economic wealth that we go from a plutonomy to a plutocracy.
Right.
And he says, we put so much of a burden on the government that on itself, that the government can't do things for the public good. Who is the we?
Yep.
Because when we say, does he mean like 90% of the people out there? Or does he mean the we being the people who send the lobbyists, who have the money, who buy the elections, who buy the legislature, who provide all of the roadblocks to doing what supposedly we are trying to do? I mean, this is the fundamental flaw in his thinking, is that he thinks there is some sort of like entity that is static, that there is no such thing as power dynamics, that there is, he has no sense of power. And this is what has always been absence of his politics. And the reason why you don't recognize power from his position is because you're not on the losing end of it. In his politics, the horse knows the rider more than the rider knows the horse.
And when he's talking about the regulations, we, as you say, who is the we that we put on government? I'm not necessarily sure what he means by that. I would have to read more of his book to figure that out. But it seems like he's ignoring the fact that oftentimes this red tape and the lag in delivering for people, it seems like a bit kind of reheated deliverance arguments for the Biden administration from 2020, by the way. The reason that government doesn't deliver for people is because of the regulations we put on government. Or could it be the fact that, unfortunately, we have legalized campaign finance, almost bribery in this country, where there's an influx of corporate money? And on the local level in particular, the yield for corporate interests is higher because they don't have to, they can get more for their money, basically. So there's all this self-dealing that happens on the local level, and they have to take into account this campaign contributor and not run afoul of them if they want to build something here. Or this real estate investor is mad that we want to build affordable housing near their complex or whatever. That's the red. That's the issue. That's the issue with stuff not being delivered quickly enough. And he seems to ignore that.
Well, that's the whole point. He's not even, he doesn't even seem to be aware of it, because even in that question, if he had an awareness of it, he would stop and say, he wouldn't say we. Because, I mean, it's like, who is the we?
Yeah.
Like, are we preventing more public transportation?
Minneapolis literally did zoning reform.
Right.
It's a progressive government. The other thing is like, this is all sort of a larger problem of, like, how do we get back to building things in America? And it is so insane to me that we are having this concept without reference to, say, the country that's actually building things, which is China. Like, they greenlit flying taxis the other day. They definitely don't have a shortage of housing and things like that. It's because, it's not because they're letting the capitalists, you know, bequeath abundance to them. They are controlling their activity strictly and channeling it towards social ends.
Our infrastructure is falling apart, although, you know, the Biden administration did make some good investments in that. But it's not as efficient as it could be, because these are subsidies oftentimes for private contractors. And that is where we see, because under capitalism, these guys have to get rich, where we see some of the lack of efficiency and the frustration that he's describing there. And I also just, like, don't understand when he talks, he mentions there that it's,
you,
it's
mentioned some
kind of, I forget his exact phrasing, but when he mentions that it's kind of illegal for the government to build public housing, that
shouldn't be.
But why is that the case? That's
that regulation by the capitalists.
He never.
That's the whole point. It's like, it's not like, it's as if it's just sort of like dropped out of the heavens, and we, you know, we need to be very cautious about this. No, that's not the way legislation is formed. And right. That's what the very bizarre thing about it. He is standing as if the we is not like an amorphous thing that a different waxes and wanes at different points.
Yeah, it's this annoying kind of habit that on, I think this, like,
yes, this is exactly the good point.
But it's this annoying habit of gesturing towards, like, what the left is saying or what critics are saying without addressing it at all.
Well, but no, but see, yes, but what it ultimately is, it's a critique of government. By saying that we can't, like, government just can't do this.
Yeah.
It is there as if there is something structurally wrong with government, as opposed to there's something structurally wrong with our society. And that being that money is the one is hampering government's ability to do it, because when government does something, it cuts into money, private money's profit.
Yep.
They don't want public transportation. And that they, in that instance, is the fossil fuel industry.
Or Uber.
Or Uber. Or Elon Musk. With his Hyperloop.
And self-driving promises. You can put that in.
I mean, that's the dynamic. That's why the people who are obsessed with oligarchy. It is because it fundamentally, almost definitionally, the existence of an oligarchy undermines the capacity of government to do things that benefit the vast majority of people. That is definitionally the problem with an oligarchy. Not that I hate that guy because he, look at the way he dresses, or, you know, like, they have so much money, or just like pure. He reduces the issue with oligarchs and with concentrated wealth to an aesthetic.
Right.
As opposed to fundamentally undermining government's capacity to provide for a wide range of people.
And
again, all governments redistribute wealth and benefit. And it's just a question of which direction does it go?
And yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a theme to respond to your critics that they're obsessed with the oligarchy, as he derisively says, while not addressing the problems that oligarchy present to the very part of his book that is being criticized, or the very central thesis to his book. And again, if this was something that was marketed as, hey, these are some friendly tips that local governments can engage in to further along helping their constituents, I don't think the reaction would be what it is. But the fact that it's abundance, and it's on every liberal podcast here, and this is about the vision for the Democratic Party, and you have Josh Shapiro saying, I'm all aboard the abundance agenda train, it is a really bad time to be making this argument.
Well, also,
and it's a really bad time to be making the argument that government is the problem, especially as we have that government is the problem, and also maybe we shouldn't be too focused on the oligarchy, as we have a billionaire oligarch who is destroying our government right now. And so, like, to the point of, I kind of feel bad for him. It is like poorly timed.
I was being facetious.
I know, but that was my first instinct. That was my first instinct, right? Because I wanted to be fair to it. But when I heard how defensive he got about Zephyr Teachout's accurate critique of the book, okay, so we're just reheating neoliberalism again. Again, again, again.
We should be extremely angry as a society with the people who have been charged with the economic priorities of this country, which is who Ezra and Derek Thompson are defending with this book, saying we just need to let them cook. Actually, we're behind everywhere. We're behind on green energy. We're behind on personal vehicles. We're behind on, I mean, healthcare. We're behind on all of this stuff. And the idea that it's just like, oh, we need to let the financiers and capitalists like decide how to do it. We're back where we were in the New Deal, where we realized actually we need the government to build this stuff, because these people don't actually know how to unleash the productive capacity of this country.
Yeah.
Well, they know how to unleash the productive capacity, their own productive
capacity.
Profit seeking. I mean,
yeah.
You know, the theory has always been pursue your self-interest and it'll be best for society. And the fact is, no. What happens more often than not, and we can see this in the concentration of wealth, is in the pursuit of their own best interest, they necessarily inhibit other people from being from getting wealth.
And they've all been banking on AI, and now China does that better than us, or at least cheaper than us, too.
Yeah, and honestly, it's a little bit frustrating to even have to have this conversation with somebody who is nominally on the liberal or the left side or the Democratic side. The numbers are clear about wealth concentration and how we are at extreme levels that is immiserating the rest of the population. You think that housing is inoculated from that? I mean, I would guess he would say that's too simplistic of an argument, and it's okay. It's a question.
That's exactly
of,
what he said.
Fine, but
I mean,
but,
they talk about housing without talking about the 2008 financial crisis. So I mean, they're not deep here.
The point is just that it's about what are we emphasizing. We've said this before in the context of being in the news. You have a finite number of things that you can focus on a day-to-day basis. I mean, we're going to always have fun, whatever, for on our show. But what you choose to focus on is even more, I think, indicative of your ideology than what you say. And that's the problem with this book.
I don't even care about the book as much as I do the movement. I mean, the fact of the matter
mediator,
is,
yeah.
I mean, the fact of the matter is, a guy with a New York op-ed, I mean, these guys are not writing a book that isn't that is meant to be small bore, technical, housing reform on a small.
Exactly.
That's not what they're doing.
How do we square the billionaire circle with the democracy square?
Exactly. This is like, you know, how do we make the Democratic Party Mark Cuban safe? All right, we're gonna read some IMs. Get out of here. Pam Bondi just recommended seeking the death penalty for Luigi Mangione. I mean,
sorry, I thought the IMer was named Pam Bondi, and I was laughing, but no, that's insane. Yeah,
That is not going to be popular.
This is the populace, right?
That is not going to be popular. I mean, aside from like, I mean, look, I'm against the death penalty for everybody. I mean, in any circumstance, I don't think we should abolish it, state, federal.
Yep.
levels. I don't care how horrific of a crime that was committed.
Dropped from the Democratic Party platform for the first time in years for some reason.
The abolishing of the capital punishment.
Because they were worried that, you know,
but,
tough on crime. Or
as a political matter, I would imagine that's also going to be far more problematic for them than they realize. New Brendan 3, Sam and crew, is it irresponsible of Owen Higgins to signal boost Representative Kamala Gerdove's sex pest attack on Matt Taibbi when he knows full well no one has accused Matt of any sex crimes? I have no idea what you're talking about. And so I think it's irresponsible for you to IM us about something that's so
specific and narrow. Yes.
Leftist Big Pharma plug. Hey, Sam and crew, FYI, as of this morning, mass firings at the FDA. Several critical review divisions for drugs, biologics, devices have been completely eradicated. Yes. And I would also say, I mean, I've got the FDA. I've got they've laid off a lot of the IRS IT people. It's April 1st, incidentally. They have essentially shut down the IMLS, which is the Museum and Library Services. Full budget of like $295 million that went to support museums and libraries. And they're basically destroying that agency. They can't hand out grants if you don't have anybody working there. It's just grotesque. Left pharma plug, just list of all sorts of people at that agency. I mean, it's a disaster. It's going to be a disaster. NJ Mailman, do you guys see China, Japan, and Korea are going to stand together? Tariffs against the U.S. Talk about the greater unifying theory of F that guy. It was Chinese social media reports that. I'm not sure how accurate it is, but invariably, if we do this, you're gonna see a lot trade alliances like this. Scary Carrie, not sure if this is an April Fool's Day prank, but I heard the new college in Florida was taken over by Republicans is being renamed to Trump University. That's got to be a joke. And Bonara, the George W. Bush administration could, with complete support by both parties, establish the standards that you are a terrorist. If we say you are, and we can do anything we want forever. So now we're simply expanding this to anyone who's a terrorist or gang member. If we say you are, we can do whatever we want. Jazz Apple, honest question after I had a terrifying thought yesterday. Is it remotely possible and legal for Trump to deputize Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, January Sixers to violently suppress protests? I don't know that they need to deputize these people. All they need to do is just to tell their own people, don't do anything about it. I mean, what is Kyle Rittenhouse?
Well, also check out
what is Kyle Rittenhouse from
Black Lives Matter protests and how cops, there's been, I forget where it was, but even undercover stuff where you see, or it's take from their live streams of Proud Boys, like dapping up between cops and,
yeah,
and these groups.
I mean,
like, they kind of have a handshake agreement.
You don't see the police going after armed, you know, vigilantes. When Kyle Rittenhouse went out there with a gun, is running around, they basically just say, like, okay, you guys are sort of on our side. Jerry S.K. Holt, Elon probably went through this program for Social Security when he immigrated. When did he immigrate? Because this was probably established with DHS, but maybe there was some type of program like it. Bingo dango. This is 100% purpose to tell immigrants you should leave too. We might make more mistakes. Yeah. Marilyn Mailman, since PBD's wall, this time Sam, sign. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes. Sign the wall this time.
We're going to bring that up. Special Edward, I think we should primary all Democrats, whether we like them or not. I am all in favor of primaries across the board. You know, yep.
there's an argument that you don't want to expend resources in, you know, there's not an unlimited amount of resources. But broadly speaking, I'm not against any primary. Dragon Rider just bought a pillow from Mike, and it's one kilogram of white powder. It's hard to sleep on. I stay awake constantly. All right, two more. Trump from the Eve. I have never seen Sam at such a loss of words in my entire life. Perhaps this is a sign from God that you're not meant to watch another Mike Lindell clip ever again. Verified X user. That guy on the right nodding the whole time was Mike rambling is making me feel insane. Ladies and gentlemen, we have someone to introduce.
Oh.
I mean, we'll do a proper one tomorrow. But, you know, because doing it like a 2:43. It's
awkward too, because I like renounced my position at Lindell TV not that long ago. So,
well, that's
better to wait.
We poached them from Lindell TV. Russ, oh, you want to? Should we say
your? Should we turn on your camera?
Wait, you can put the camera on.
I think there's a minute.
There you are.
Oh, there he is. That's a great shot. We got to maybe work
on
that camera. That camera's not.
Oh, there he is.
Oh, there he is.
Hello, Russ.
There's Russ.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Happy to have you. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Well, I was at Lindell TV for the last 2 or so years, and it got a little rough these last few months. So,
and you,
I appreciate the opportunity.
And then you had a brief stint setting up Tim Pool's skate park, weren't you? Like very good with bending plywood, is my what I hear.
I can't be held legally responsible for anything that happens at that skate park.
Right.
So I'd rather not comment
not
on
sure,
it.
Not sure you know about the building code situation, right? All right. Well,
but I'm glad to be here, and I'm going to work to try to bring some ideological diversity to the show, given my background. So I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah. I appreciate it, because it just means the left can finally start having conversations again. So.
Exactly. Exactly. We're willing to bring in a right-winger.
That's what it's all about.
Mr. Melancholy. All right, final IM of the day. Should we worry about an upcoming depression? It seems like much money isn't being distributed because of these cuts, let alone the amount of people going to be unemployed. I mean, I think seems reasonable to think that we might have a recession, but we'll see.
Yep.
Matt, Russ, finally I get to say that. It's been so difficult. Emma, great job today. Folks, we'll see you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know. The choice is made for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101.